This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawera Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann and I am joined by Mawera Karatai. Kia ora, Mawera.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. We've got an exciting project underway.
We do. And this is our very first episode of our exciting project. And I'm really happy that Danielle Gardner is our first person to go through this process. We have a University of Otago students who are mostly completing their Masters of Sustainable Business have all created their own podcast in a series called Coming Up for Air, and we will be sharing those podcasts as part of Blowing Bubbles over the next few weeks.
Indeed, the next lots of weeks.
Yes, lots and lots of weeks. Yeah, especially because our second cohort of students have already been told that that's for them too. So it's going to be so good.
So let's
Danielle.
Go.
Danielle, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Danielle, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Auckland and I am still there. I've only ever lived on the North Shore, so no idea what happens over the bridge.
Is that because you found the perfect place or don't you have much ambition?
Partially a husband decision. He really loves the North Shore. I always thought I was going to live in town and be one of those people who stomp around the streets and go to gigs and all of that, but that never happened, and I kept living my nice suburban life for the last, let's not say how many years.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
There were a few things. One of the first things I remember was a mechanic, until my aunt dutifully told me about how dirty my hands would become and they would stay that way forever. Then I wanted to be a choreographer, dance choreographer, and I still do like a little bit of that in my own time, I guess, amateurly. Then I wanted to be a fashion designer, and I did that, and that was the first part of my career. And actually studying with Otago was one of the very first serious steps I made in my career change.
First part of your career? That suggests you went somewhere else.
Oh, I've started going somewhere else now. Yeah, so...
What led you to...
Chapter one, fashion designer. Chapter
okay,
two,
let's go for chapter one.
Sustainability professional.
Let's go for chapter one. What led you to fashion design?
It was just a personal interest and passion of mine. I love music a lot, which hence the dance choreography part of things. And so I was really interested in street fashion and fashion that related to music scenes and underground scenes and all that punk culture of the 70s onwards. Like, all of that was really interesting to me as a young person. So yeah, I went and studied fashion design, got a degree, couldn't help myself, started my own label, and I did that part-time for 16 years. I love making stuff, and I love sort of the problem-solving of design, so that creative thinking side of things. It was learning more and more about the global fashion industry as I went through my years and I started doing blogging, started researching, writing about fashion on the side, that it was hard to unsee. And I came to a weird crossroads where I had to decide, was I going to continue in fashion when I know what's going on and that, you know, enough clothes already exist in the world, so why would I keep making more when, yeah, so that's how I'm here now.
So that sort of, that strange relationship of fashion to sustainability led you to be thinking, was it, I want to get out of fashion or I want to do something different but in a sustainable space?
It was just something I couldn't reconcile anymore. My brain couldn't get around, why would we keep doing this when this no longer makes sense? And I know that with a sustainability mindset, I'm maybe ahead of others are in that journey, and they haven't quite realized that a lot of this stuff doesn't make sense, the way that we do things in a linear way and create demand and create overconsumption and all of that. Yeah, that was just something I couldn't sit with anymore and be a part of, I guess. And I could see that I could make more change by getting into sustainability in a professional sense than I could by being the head of a label, being like, hey guys, buy sustainable, buy local, I'm making my stuff out of cotton. So it was the breadth of influence that was attractive to me. I just felt the crisis and thought, well, let's use my time to do as much as I can with it.
We face that a lot in computing, that people work on green computing, but you're only going to get the benefits of that green computing if you buy more stuff. And fashion is the same, in the same space. Is there a solution to that tension?
Yes, there's even brands like, so Vivienne Westwood's been a big one that I followed for years for obvious reasons. And she was one of the first brands to start being like, don't buy my stuff in marketing campaigns. So there is a shift towards some brands sharing that kind of thought process where you need to shift towards less items that are of better quality so they last longer, because if we can get most people doing that, then the products that are coming out through that stream are able to then feed into a share economy kind of situation. But what we're sitting with at the moment is that all our op shops Zealand are full of really low quality fast fashion, ultra fast fashion items that are essentially textile garbage. Like, they're not going to last, they may have already fallen apart. So it is this looking for products that are going to have a long life that then can have many lives because of that, which is a step back in time really, because stuff used to be made that well and just isn't anymore.
That sounds compelling from a sustainability perspective, but does it stack up as a business model? I suppose that's not too opposite. That's the same thing, really, isn't it?
There would be definitely some business model changes, because there is still growth is still part of running a business, whatever that business is. I don't know if we have the full picture of what it will look like in fashion yet. I think it is like that different, all the different players. So it's the people who are making, it's the people who are then redistributing, say in a share economy model, renting, leasing, then the repair side of things. So there's legislation coming in the EU that is all about designing stuff that is easily repairable, and that goes for fashion as well. And even in Australia, they're working on this and looking at paying people or like reimbursing people for repairing items, because obviously that that's a cost at the moment, that people go, well, I could buy a new one for basically the same cost, so why wouldn't I do that? So yeah, I think it's legislation, it's new business models, it's different business models working together, but I don't know how we stop the linear part entirely.
In some countries, there is now a requirement that if you produce a product, you have to have a plan for how it's recycled, repurposed, reused, yep. What happens to it at the end of its life. What would happen to fashion if that rule is applied?
There would be maybe more investment in textile tech. So there are people already working on how to recycle different fibres. An issue at the moment is that a lot of the fabrics are blends, which are really hard to recycle. So people will go, oh, well, it's mostly cotton, but we also wove in a little nylon just so it like lasts longer. But then it becomes a non-recyclable product later, now that we're looking at recycling them. So I think that'll change how either the tech will become better so it can pull all of those different parts separately, or it'll also, and or it'll drive different textiles to be manufactured with that in mind. So it'll be just like solo fibers and fabrics again, which you can still buy, but there's fewer of them and it's not prioritized for that very reason. You'd see maybe a lot of saving of the little items within, like zips and buttons and studs and things that you can pull out. There are companies overseas working on how to do that easily enough, because that's the thing, is that it's currently all very manual to pull stuff apart, and so then it has this overhead cost that's just not attractive to people.
Do you think your insights from fashion will translate across to a wider business, sustainability business space?
I think yes. I think understanding the complexity of supply chain and then also the complexity of product design and also what consumers want and how they buy, their buying habits. Even given all the information you can put in front of people, and still there's reasons not to spend the money or not to buy the thing that's more sustainable. So I think a lot of those translate quite well across. The supply chain thing and the globalization thing is a big one, I think, particularly in bigger companies that do have footprints across the globe, or at least across the ditch. Yeah.
We've been talking mostly about fashion, but you're not doing that anymore. Where are you heading?
No. I currently work for Westpac. So I've gone, corporate sustainability. Before that, I worked for an insurance company, which is where I first sort of started getting into corporate sustainability and seeing how that worked and how my skills were relevant there. Also with that risk lens and climate change that as well is very, very front and center. So again, why I've chosen this over the fashion path is because companies like banks have such a bigger footprint and are involved in so many different businesses. So instead of running one business and being, the best leader for that one business with its smaller footprint because it's quite niche, I now work in a sustainability team for a big bank in New Zealand that has a lot of businesses under its umbrella. So I can see the potential there for wider impact.
So you've joined the dark side.
No. Something like that. But I'm very hopeful about where Westpac in particular are going. I'm very excited to have joined their sustainability team. They have more than one which is incredible. So I'm in the team that's more the reporting, governance, what internally the bank is doing.
I was going to say, is it a mix of that team? Is it working on a mix of the bank's own sustainability footprint and handprint, and or what impact it can have more widely?
My team specifically is the more internal what's happening, but it all feeds into what everyone else is doing as well. So we also own the responsibility over position statements, so things like human rights, and then we have to, you know, start talking to business units who deal with humans, and make products for humans, and how are they reporting and measuring their possible human rights risks, and how are they thinking about these things when they're designing products or when they're dealing with customers. So it does start spreading out across the bank, which is great.
Let's take your music choice. Let's have Kendall Elise, Belgrave Place. Why this one?
This one specifically had the topic, which was my own podcast. So it is about not being able to find a place to settle and having to move on a lot, which my podcast is on housing and first home buyers and people not being able to get into homes. So I felt that this was quite relevant.
Seems like my Bride of the Forest of Orokonui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi araha nui kia koutou, ko tahua hou. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are. A triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now I know that for us all the last several years have been very tough, and it's so important that we allow ourselves to accept the support of others, the kindness, the compassion, the time, the care, the listening ears, the offered shoulders, the silence that can be so restorative with a dear friend who we've known for a long time. And for ourselves, to give ourselves self-compassion, to understand that for all of us, we are in a process of recovery, that for all of us, the whole world was turned upside down. The world that we knew and the world that we took for granted really changed. And this is a big shock for everybody. And in many ways, the world is tired. And in many ways, we need to find ways to rest. We need to find approaches that allow us to restore and recuperate our energies without any sense that this isn't what we should be doing. And of course we find ourselves in a situation where we must work and we must support our whānau and those we love. And so finding the right balance and the right pathway to meeting our responsibilities, sustaining the lives of those around us who we love and our own life out in consensus reality, but also finding ways within those frameworks to enable us to rest. And one of the ways, of course, that we can do this in all aspects of our life is to remember that within us there is a place, there's a realm that is untouched by the external world. And this place is a place of peace. This place is a place of perfection and reflection. And at any time we can take a step back from that consensus reality, from the hustle and bustle of that life, and we can retreat to this inner sanctuary. And within this inner sanctuary, we can remember our true essence. We can reconnect with our wairua, with our spirit, with our soul, with that part of us who accompanies so many other aspects of us and is observing, is guiding, is protecting, and has much wisdom and comfort to share. I know for me, I have had to take a step back into this inner sanctuary a number of times this year, and it has been of such benefit to me. And I really hope for all of you, wherever you are, whatever's happening around you, you have the opportunity to grow your connection with this part of yourself that is always with you, that is observing your life, that is witnessing your life, and that loves you. It's an important part of all of us that we've been gifted. And of course, being part of this show is a huge pleasure and privilege. So a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. And I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Danielle Gardner.
Danielle, before our listeners actually get to hear your podcast, which I have heard and it's awesome, before they get to hear it, what would you like them to know about the what and the why?
The what is, this is about a shared equity housing model of home ownership, which was very new to me and was very interesting because of that. And why is because I am an elder millennial renter in Auckland. So it was very personal and very visceral to know how big this problem is because I live in it. And then start finding out that there were really interesting and different opportunities for home ownership that aren't really talked about. Like we just think there's one way into housing, but there isn't. So that's why I did this podcast.
That's so cool.
Kia ora, and welcome to this week's episode of Coming Up for Air, a podcast about contemporary issues in the sustainable business world, featuring innovative insights from New Zealand business leaders, brought to you by Master of Sustainable Business students from the University of Otago. I'm Danielle Gardner, your host for this week, and I'm here to talk to you about New Zealand's housing affordability issue and how we may address at least a part of this complex problem through a shared equity finance model. As an elder millennial renter in Auckland, it was no surprise to me to hear that in 2021, 17% of Auckland households, around 97,000 of them, couldn't afford to service a mortgage for a house in the lower quartile, a property worth about $770,000. This is a troubling statistic. 17% of households were effectively locked out of the housing market, which, from a wealth standpoint alone, has a huge impact on those households' access to long-term financial security. This stability disparity is due to there being a lack of other investment opportunities in New Zealand, which would provide the same return for a household by retirement age. In short, home ownership is key to domestic financial security in New Zealand. So, while property prices have historically risen at a rate that outpaced wage growth, how can we help that 17% into a home that is theirs? This is where the shared equity model is being explored, alongside other part ownership approaches like leasehold. Shared equity involves a purchaser, a bank, and an equity provider, who, with their powers combined, are able to fund a property purchase for households who otherwise couldn't afford the mortgage on the full sale price. I am joined today by Heiko Jonkers, the Senior Product Manager for Social and Affordable Housing at Westpac, who is incredibly passionate and knowledgeable about the shared equity model and how it can benefit those who have been historically locked out of the housing market. As a disclaimer, both myself and Heiko work for Westpac, which is how we met. The opinions shared in our interview are our own. Welcome, Heiko, and thank you for joining us this week on Coming Up for Air. As a sustainability student and professional, I love that your role exists in the bank. Please tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to work in the social and affordable housing space at Westpac.
So I've been at Westpac for 7 years. 2017 I joined with no banking experience. I came from a tier 2 FinCo background, which is very different from banking, and got into the policy team through some good networking and through a period of being presented with problems to solve that were surrounded to housing, began to develop the body of knowledge around affordable housing. The more I learned about it, the more interested I got in it, and the more that I read, and the better I understood how things worked. I'm very good at sort of joining dots together, so I can picture a systems flow very easily. I mean, it's like my weird skill. So I became quite an expert at how an affordable housing solution should technically sit together so that the bank's interests were protected, but more importantly, the family's interests were protected. Because a lot of the early contracts I saw were very much weighted in favour of the provider, and I didn't think that was fair. If you were going to get into a home loan, you should have the same risks and benefits and enjoy the same outcomes as a regular homeowner as much as possible. By developing that technical expertise, I got asked to do more and more, and slowly the program started to develop and we started getting a lot of loans on board. Then there was a bit of career disruption at Westpac, where the team I was in got restructured and my role no longer existed, which was strangely actually quite fortuitous because it created an opportunity to have a very respectful conversation with Westpac to say, hey, I don't have a job anymore. I love working here. I want to have a long-term career here, and I'd love the housing function to be my next career. I was also very fortunate to have some very strong advocates who believed not only in the cause that we were trying to build, but also in my ability to help build that cause. And over a period of several months, I was very lucky to get strong access to members of the ET to tell my story, and they said yes. So that's how I became the head of social affordable housing. It's a completely new role. It's a new department. It sits within the product team. I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunity because it's amazing. And I love coming to work. I love what I do. And the opportunities are endless for the sector.
Oh, wow. Sounds like Westpac's put the right person in the right role. Please tell us more about the affordable housing projects you've been involved with so far.
I started being given opportunities to look at certain projects. And one of them was to look at how we could fund a prefabricated house while it was being built. Because the way the Property Law Act works in New Zealand is that we can only take security over a house if it's attached to land. And of course, a prefab house is not attached to land while it's being built. So being an equipment funder, that was right up my alley. And I solved that problem, and that became a product that we still sell today. That then led to a project request to help out with something called shared equity, which I'd never heard of before and couldn't quite get my head around, but found intriguing. And I sort of worked out how shared equity worked and saw the potential of it and started analysing a lot of contracts. This is now sort of 5 or 6 years ago. The providers were coming with their own bespoke contracts and saying, could you look at these? We want you to fund them. So having reviewed 5 or 6 contracts, I became very good at understanding how shared equity worked and eventually developed a standard form set of contracts for the bank and for the provider and for the participant. And then that led to, well, could you look at this thing called leasehold and how can we improve leasehold to address affordable housing? And the more I got into it, the better I got at it and the better I was at it, the more intrigued I became in the whole social housing problem. And the more exposed I got to some of the really quite sad stories of people who have done all the right things in life, made all the right decisions, got themselves educated, have got good jobs, can't afford a house. And that led to me asking sort of a whole bunch of open questions around, well, what does that mean for New Zealand? And what does housing mean for New Zealanders? It made me realise how big the problem really is. And when we talk about housing problems, the market and the government tends to talk about the low end. When I say the low end, I mean the low end of the housing continuum, the very left-hand side where social housing is and homelessness, which is a huge problem. But they don't talk about sort of the middle of the housing continuum, that space between renting and owning, where there are a whole bunch of people who would love to own a home and should be able to own a home but can't because the housing market is accelerating away from them. So that's how I got involved. I just found it a really interesting problem. And the more I learned about it, I realized it was actually a really important problem and I wanted to be involved.
What was it about the social housing issue that you found so interesting?
I realized that I came from quite a privileged background and I'd also been quite fortunate in periods of my life where the day that I wanted to buy a house, I just went and bought one. And I was lucky I had worked in London for a number of years in a period where the mix of exchange rate and earning opportunity came together perfectly. So I had a deposit and I just walked up to a real estate agent and said, I'd like to buy a house, please. And she showed me some houses and I bought one. And naively, I thought everybody did that. Until I started hearing stories about, no, there's a lot of people who are trapped in renting. And I just thought that wasn't very fair. So I have a personal thing that fairness is big for me. Fairness and equality is something that I hold personally is very important. And I just thought, well, the banking industry is more than a place where we just process loans and do debits and credits for people. payments and cash machines and what have you. Banks are enablers. Good banking is enabling people to realize their dreams. And if there is a growing cohort of society who are just stuck because the earnings growth is not keeping up with housing growth, how can the bank think differently about what it's doing without stepping out of its risk parameters to enable that cohort of people to own homes? And that problem I found really interesting. And I just got fired up and super enthusiastic about it and wouldn't take no for an answer. And the bank also initially was a bit bemused by what I was doing. I was a policy guy. Why are you looking at this housing stuff? But the more I researched it and the more I talked about it, the more advocates I got on board. And eventually Westpac said, yes, we agree. This is a big problem and we can be part of the solution. And that's a hugely privileged position to be in, to work in an organization who gets it and says, yes, we're going to help you solve this problem.
From the sounds of things, shared equity is just one piece of the puzzle to addressing New Zealand's housing affordability issue. Who do you believe the people shared equity can help the most?
Shared equity is one part of the housing solution. There are many ways that people can get into owning a home. There are ways that people can get into owning a home individually through low equity options. So that's for people who've got very strong servicing but not a lot of equity. Then you've got structures that involve family guarantees. And if you're privileged enough to have a family with money, then there's a family guarantee or sort of like a co-investment style. Shared equity suits people who don't have access to family money, who don't have the ability to borrow in their own capacity outright to buy the home and are unlikely to be able to save on their own to be able to buy a house in the future. So effectively, their rate of savings growth does not match or outpace the rate of growth in the housing market. So they're always behind the curve. So what shared equity does is it fractionalizes the ownership of the house. So imagine a house that's worth $100, just in a very much imaginary sense. If a person only has the capacity to borrow $65 and has $10 of their own equity, they are $25 short to buy the house that's worth $100. So what shared equity does is there is generally a community housing provider organization will play a role and they will put in that $25 and own 25% of the home alongside that person. Those are all very structured models. They generally rely on philanthropic or government money. And generally, it's individuals who earn less than $90,000 or couples who earn less than $150,000 qualify for that assistance. So why should somebody want it? If you want to own a house and you can't, then by definition, you're renting. If you're renting, you have zero participation in the housing market. So you are paying a mortgage, but you're paying someone else's mortgage for no gain, apart from the right to live in that house. If you own a house outright, you have in your hand 100% participation in the housing market. So you get all the gain and all the benefits. What shared equity does, so going back to that earlier model, you have $65 of loan, you have $10 of your own, you get to own 75% of the potential capital gain of that home, which is much better than owning nothing. And that's what's exciting about these types of models, is it changes the way that people own homes in a way that doesn't materially impinge on their rights as a homeowner. You still get the capital gain, you still get the rights and benefits of having the home, you get the enjoyment of living in the community of choice, you have tenure, you can't be kicked out of that home unless you materially misbehave and breach the contract you have with the equity provider, and you get to build future wealth. It's a very powerful model. The limitation of the model, however, though, is funding. So for someone to buy a shared equity house, we need a community housing provider to build that house or purchase it in the open market and provide it in a shared equity context. And there is just not enough funding to do that. So that's where the challenge gets interesting, is, well, how can we change that funding model to open up more opportunities?
If you could change one thing right now that would make the most significant positive difference for the future, what would that be?
It's not one thing. That's the problem. It's not one thing. So what do we need? We need more housing supply, but we need more housing supply of quality homes. We need New Zealanders to think differently about what a home looks like. So I'm Dutch. I have been to the home that I was born in, and it is a fully attached terrace house with no garage on a street with not a lot of lawn. That house is now probably at least 60 or 70 years old. It still looks as good now as it did when I was there 50 years ago. The Dutch are very good at putting a lot of people in a small space. So how do they do that? They're very efficient with their house building. They're very efficient with their public transport links. New Zealand doesn't do that. Everybody wants a lawn. The way that we build houses for 50 years. In European nations, they build them for 100 years. So we need to build more houses to last longer and for people to be prepared to live in a much more dense environment. Spreading out is not the answer because we don't have the roading and infrastructure links and public transport links to support that. We need the shared equity and also the leasehold sector as well to develop and be more accepted so that we have different ways of owning a home. So in New Zealand, home ownership is effectively an all or nothing process. You either own a home or you don't. So what shared equity does and also leasehold, it lets you own part of a home and actually get the same level of return, like this, so proportionally, that's a good outcome. If you're stuck in renting, that's a great outcome, and we need more people to accept that and be prepared to fund that. So yeah, so it's not one thing, because if it was one thing, we would do that. It's a very complex problem. There is one thing that would above all else be good, which is consistency in government, a consistent set of rules in the long term that lets people plan, because governments change every 3 to 6 years. The new government comes in, throws stones at the old government, changes all the rules, and there's no consistency, there's no longevity of a program. That needs to change. At the very least, change that. The government PHO program was actually doing really well. The Kāinga Ora put 1,200 people into a shared equity home over a period of about 18 months. That's awesome. Like, that's really good. Then the funding stopped. So if that is successfully getting people into homes, let's keep doing that. But do it in a way that makes sure that people are getting in there properly and they've got a long-term positive outcome ahead of them as opposed to just looking for volume.
A big thank you to Heiko for sharing his insights with us as a business leader working in the social and affordable housing space. So, what do we think? Can a shared equity model help to answer at least a part of New Zealand's housing affordability issue? The model looks to provide an equitable way for households to participate in home ownership and reap all the benefits that come with putting down roots and paying your own mortgage, not someone else's. However, it unfortunately has some current limitations whereby it relies on government, iwi, or philanthropic funding to deliver that last piece of equity that the borrower needs. The previous government's Progressive Home Ownership Fund has helped to contract over 1,700 households into their own homes since December 2020. But there is some uncertainty around the fund's future, with Kāinga Ora having to close its first home partner scheme in September 2023 due to excess demand. All sustainability issues, whether environmental or social, need to be tackled with a long-term view. So here's hoping that the current government pulls the right levers to continue building resiliency and financial security for New Zealand households by getting as many of those households as possible into their own homes. And at the same time, New Zealanders see the benefit of stepping outside of the traditional way of home ownership to leverage an arrangement like shared equity to afford a place where they can belong, raise their family in, and reap the financial rewards in the long term. With leaders like Heiko bringing their vim and vigour to this contemporary issue, I have faith that we'll get there. Thank you for joining this week's episode of Coming Up for Air. E noho rā.
Danielle, that was absolutely outstanding. From the conversation that you had, what is the thing that you got out of it? What was your favourite thing or the most significant thing that you got from the process?
Meeting Heiko properly was really wonderful. I'd crossed paths with him before and had sort of just been eavesdropping on him, talking to other people in the bank about all this shared equity stuff. He's got a housing continuum model, which he can just draw at the drop of a hat, and it shows very clearly how there's different bands of ownership and how anything above renting is good. So that's not something that I was really aware of before. I thought that you had to have perfect home ownership where you owned the whole thing. But actually, in terms of future wealth, anywhere that's beyond renting is good. Leasehold is good, shared equity is good, It's all like heading towards full ownership, but like anywhere is better than renting. So that was a big one for me. It was a huge mind shift. And I love meeting him because we've now built a relationship that I will now be drawing on to talk to him much more, I'm sure, in the future and work with him on hopefully that project and report about how that project's going because it's new at the bank as well. So, yeah.
Okay, so we have some questions to end the show. What is the biggest success you've had in the last year or so?
Landing that job. Really. I was only halfway through, well, not even halfway through my master's, and I took a punt, saw the ad, and I thought I would have to finish my whole degree before I would actually start applying for jobs. But I'd already met Belinda through, who's my boss at Westpac, through an event that unfortunately my old work had hosted. So they made the connection, and I spoke with her, and it was a really good fit, and I ended up in the team, and I couldn't be happier. Yeah, it's shifted my life in a big way. I've gone from years and years of part-time to full-time, doing sustainability instead of doing it on the side of my desk as a hobby and as part of my business as well, I guess, in the past, but still in like a big bad way by comparison. So yeah, no, it's that's been my win.
That's such a common story that people find themselves doing sustainability as a hobby almost in secret.
Yeah.
What's your superpower?
Communication, I think, in both a verbal and visual way. So I've very quickly taken up all the PowerPoint jobs in my team. I'm like happy to do it. Yeah, I really enjoy being able to distill some of this complex sustainability stuff down for people who don't get it yet, and I've been practicing it for ages because I've been trying to do that with everyone who was buying clothes for years. So yeah, now it's getting even more complex as I learn more and more about how stuff shifted and more about the very business world through this degree. So more to distill down, so yeah, but practice, so good grounding.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Absolutely. Yes. I went to the fast track protest, fast track bill protest, and yeah, no, I call myself a grown up punk because I don't look it anymore, but it's definitely still in there, in my heart.
So, what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Making a change. Making the good change. Doing that work. Putting in the grunt work. Hoping for that light. There's shift. So there's hope. Like there's stuff happening and stuff shifting. And the things I've seen changing in the last, what, like 5 years probably has been really great. Like the legislations we were talking about earlier overseas, there's stuff shifting, so I have hope and I love being part of it.
And what challenge or opportunity are you looking forward to in the next year or so?
Probably finishing my master's. That's yeah. Gonna be a big one. Yeah, I'll be undertaking my research project next year, so the aim is to pick something that's going on at Westpac, deep dive into that, and hopefully solve a real world problem with that work. Maybe I'll work with Heiko, who knows? Yeah, that's going to be the one. It's going to be exciting.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yes. I think find joy and find hopeful stories. If you happen to be a person in sustainability, it can get rough and there is a lot of grim stuff out there, but stuff has also changed a lot and quickly, so there's good out there. I can recommend a podcast called The Joy Report, and anything else that's like that, that acknowledges that there are people out there doing good work and they don't necessarily get in front of everyone in the all the time, and news cycles focus on all the negative and all the crisis part. So yeah, hold on to, if you can find something like the Joy Report or something similar, another influencer or someone who's telling like the good stories that are hopeful, and get involved. Vote. Oh my God, vote, please. That's another one. At the very least, vote.
Thank you very much for that, Mawira.
Danielle, it has been a joy to, well, I've had the amazing privilege of being in a classroom with you now through three papers, and I think you're amazing. And thank you for the commitment that you have made to not just wanting to see change, but to actually truly living the change that we need to see happen. You are an amazing role model for that. And I really enjoyed your time in the classroom, and I really enjoyed your podcast as well. Thank you for sharing with us today, and all the best for the journey ahead. Kia ora.
Kia ora. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook. This is Kendall Elise.
I wanna call you by your truth.
Andrew McKenzie, and the first of our series, Coming Up for Air. Today's contribution was from Danielle Gardner, who's in Auckland. I was joined by Nawira Karatai. I'm Samuel Mann, and that was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mati wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.